This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. During his final State of the State address on Thursday, Governor Peter Shumlin talked about the possibility of legalizing marijuana, but he laid out some ground rules.
To do it right, we must do it deliberately, cautiously, step by step, and not roll it out in one leap as we legislate the lessons learned from the other states that went before us. I'll insist on five things before I'll sign the bill. First, a legal market must keep marijuana and other drugs out of the hands of underage kids, which the current system does not. Our new system must. Second, the tax imposed must be low enough to wipe out the black market and get rid of the illegal marijuana dealers. Third, revenue from legalization must be used to expand addiction prevention programs statewide. That's right. Fourth, we must strengthen law enforcement's current capacity to improve our response to impaired drivers under the influence of marijuana who are already driving on Vermont's roads right now. And fifth, take a hard lesson learned from other states and ban the sale of edibles until other states figure out how to do that one right.
So that's what Governor Shumlin wants. Five stipulations, but if they can be met, he'd like to see legalization of marijuana while he's still in office. But when we spoke with lawmakers from all three major parties represented in the State House on opening day last week, before the governor's speech, they all told us that even though they support the concept of legalization, they aren't sure it can happen this session. And that's because legalization is trickier than just saying, yes, go for it. It requires thinking about taxation, a legal framework, how neighboring states might respond. Some states that neighbor states that have legalized marijuana have sued. How to deal with impaired driving and what kinds of products might be specially labeled or not sold at all. Today on the show, we're going to talk less about the pro-con legalization argument, though that will certainly be going on over the next few months as well. Instead, we're going to be looking at some of those logistical questions. If marijuana legalization moves forward, what will it actually look like and what are the biggest hurdles to overcome? We're joined first today by Roger Marcoux, Lamoille County Sheriff. Sheriff Marcoux, thanks so much for talking with us. All right, we're going to see if we can get Sheriff Marcoux on here in just a moment. Sheriff Marcoux, do we have you now?
Yes, Jane, can you hear
good.
Me?
Oh, good. I can hear you. Thank
I'll
you so much for being on the program.
To the mic.
You sound perfect. All right, so you have thought a lot about this issue, and you were one of the people pushing to send someone from your line of work on a fact-finding trip to Colorado last year. Your contemporary, Stephen Bernard, the sheriff of Rutland County, actually went on that trip to do some fact-finding, see how it's going on the ground in Colorado. What did he bring back that sheriffs have taken to heart?
Well, there's a lot of issues that came up unexpectedly, and the biggest takeaway was that we need to take our time. Some of the folks out there in Colorado suggested that we wait and learn from them, because there are things occurring that were totally unexpected. So I think that's the biggest takeaway is there's not a big rush to get this done. Law enforcement, the sheriffs and the chiefs association are anti-legalization. The Chittenden County Law Enforcement Executive Committee wants to do much the same as Lieutenant Governor Scott and wait and see how things are progressing in the other states. So that's the biggest thing is there's not a big hurry to get this done. It's more important to get it right.
Colorado legalized marijuana sale and recreational use. It actually went into effect at the end of December of 2012. So there have been 2013, 2014, 2015, three full years then of this law in place. What more would you say we need to learn before following suit? How much longer do we need to have for those states to be legal before Vermont could make a decision?
Well, I don't know that. Sheriff Bernard shared with me that they suggested 3 to 5 years, and I don't know if those are good numbers or not. But I know that we must be certain to keep it out of the hands of underage children and students. We're having a difficult time with alcohol and cigarettes as it is now. So, you know, we've got to figure that out. In the impairment, we need a scientifically sound way of being able to determine the degree of impairment on the roadside, and I have no idea how close we are to science being able to do that for us.
You mean so not a sample that has to be taken back to a lab, but something that can be done actually at the roadside when somebody is pulled over for suspected impairment?
Right. If somebody however this looks like, if somebody is driving and they are not under the influence of to the degree where they're impaired, but they have smoked marijuana, I don't know how that would look like, but that individual probably would be treated differently than someone who is actually impaired. So we need to help out that law enforcement officer with a way of being able to determine that quickly, and sending it to a lab and waiting for that to come back isn't really the way that we want it to occur.
Sheriff Marcoux, you mentioned some of the organizations that have come out in opposition to legalizing marijuana. What's your particular personal perspective?
My personal perspective is that we should wait and see. I don't want my children being involved with getting involved with smoking marijuana, and developing any substance abuse issues early on in life. However, I think that if we just wait and legalize it, the evidence from these other states are probably going to bear out some of what our suspicions are.
What's your suspicion?
Well, that we've got a substance abuse problem in Vermont now with opiates. We have several people in this state that are addicted to marijuana. Why would we want to de-emphasize the importance to adults relative to the concerns that we have about marijuana to children and drive home the wrong message? So I don't want to create any more substance abuse issues in Vermont.
So if you had to pick your biggest concern should legalization move forward, and then assume for the sake of argument that it will move forward this session, how do you intend, maybe with your contemporaries, but how do you intend to try to deal with legalization moving forward so that you can mitigate some of your concerns?
Well, I think we have to work with our prevention and treatment partners, and I think public awareness is one of the most important things that people have to understand what they're getting into if they get involved with marijuana. I know a lot of people. I'm friends with a lot of people that have either smoked or smoked marijuana, and that doesn't make them bad people. But our job is to not only enforce the laws, but to see that the public is safe. Right now, we've got a public safety problem with butane oil, in which they're using butane to extract very concentrated hash oil, and that's a real public safety problem. That stuff blows up, so I don't know that the public is aware of that. So I think for us, we've got to figure out how we're going to keep the public safe in the various situations that we come across.
Roger Marcoux is sheriff of Lamoille County. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I know it's a squeeze in your schedule, so I appreciate it.
No, thank you, Jane.
We are looking at some of the big questions that will need to be answered if Vermont moves forward with legalizing pot. If you have a question about how edibles should be labeled or if they should be banned, or if you want to weigh in on impaired driving, the idea of dispensaries versus public cafes, should people be allowed to smoke marijuana publicly in a cafe, for example, or anything else that would go along with legalization. So not pro-con, but more like the framework for how this could be done and how it should be regulated. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Mike says, I agree, edibles should not be allowed. Most of the OD problems we've seen out west are due to these. They're difficult to regulate the effective dosage levels from strain to strain. For medical use, it makes sense because you can use the strain that works for desired effect. My biggest concern, though, Mike says, is DUI. When a new, unexperienced user first tries it, they have little knowledge of its effects on them while operating machinery of any sort. The heavy users, while knowing how to compensate, will test positive at or beyond whatever legal level is instituted, and thus face the choice either to smoke or to give up their right to drive on the roads, regardless of whatever level of impairment. John in Norwich says, I think it's inevitable that marijuana legalization will take place in Vermont, hopefully in 2016. To ensure that it's done correctly, there must be effective laws and controls in place. John says, I've been smoking marijuana for over 50 years. I am a successful retired sales executive, raised a family, and have led a good life. Unfortunately, I have to purchase marijuana from the underground market, which is quite costly and provides dealers with a good income. If the law would allow individuals to grow 3 to 4 plants per year for their own use, i.e. Colorado, it would put the pot dealers out of business and save individuals a substantial amount of money. And Virginia in Barrytown says, legalize now. That being said, I agree with the governor about edibles. Much too iffy. Sell the weed with recipes. Let people make their own brownies, cookies, butters, etc. Well, one of the people who've been thinking about this stuff pretty seriously is Bill Lofi. He's a steering committee member on the Vermont Cannabis Collaborative, and he joins us now. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. Well, we're really glad to have you. And the Cannabis Collaborative is in favor of legalization, but you've been looking at all of the specifics that will go into making it work for Vermont should it move forward. Why do you think it's a good idea to legalize marijuana?
Well, I think when we look at this debate, we really have to put it in the context of what the current status quo is. All of the issues that Roger just laid out and their real concerns are ones that exist right now. We have a problem with drug driving in Vermont right now. We have a problem with youth using marijuana right now. We have a problem with the lack of knowledge of what is in cannabis right now. We believe that regulation and really taking a thoughtful, rigorous approach to regulating this plant, that we're going to actually see better outcomes than by keeping it underground. So really it's a question of, do you want to have the current $175 million underground economy continue to operate underground, where we don't know what's in the product that people are smoking or consuming, where we are not receiving any income, any revenue out of it, and where we don't have any kind of testing protocols? Do we want to leave that underground, or do we want to bring that above ground where we can regulate it, test it, and draw some revenue, much needed revenue for the state of Vermont? And we think that that it's time to regulate in Vermont. We think we have the information we need from other states to take that that action this year.
But it must be more than just saying, you know, this is an underground problem, let's bring it above ground, because one could say that about other drugs. I mean, heroin and opiates, for example. So there's more than just, it's already happening and it's underground, let's get it out into the light.
Fair enough, but cannabis is a far, far different chemical than heroin or other drugs. And in fact, the evidence is really overwhelming. There have been zero deaths from marijuana overdoses. It just doesn't happen. It's never happened. So comparing those kinds of chemicals to cannabis is, I think, not an accurate one. Look, these are the concerns that folks have are real. They're legitimate. And I'm glad that we're focusing the conversation here on what this market might look like, because the legislature has two decisions to make, really. One is, do we go into this, do we end prohibition and move into a regulated market? And if so, how? And I think that second question is just as important as the first. We have choices. We can choose to have a market that reflects a Vermont sensibility, so where we're putting limits on the size of operations, we're keeping ownership of dispensaries and of cultivation centers in the hands of Vermonters, where we're taking a more cooperative approach to agriculture. Those are really critical choices that the legislature has in front of them if they decide to move forward with ending prohibition. And we have an opportunity to really get it right in Vermont. And our argument is that we can do so by taking thoughtful, measured actions in this legislative session.
Let's go to Paul, who's calling in from Morrisville. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Yes. Hi. I do agree with your current guest and what he said to a large extent. I have strong disagreement with Sheriff Moncou, though. I'm a 70-year-old professional. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I get my treatment from my health care treatment from the VA. And I'm tired of having to buy medical marijuana, which I need for PTSD. And I'm speaking also for a lot of fellow vets. And because Vermont has one of the most restrictive medical marijuana laws on the books, I can't get it from a doctor, from a private doctor. And of course, the VA is not allowed to prescribe it. And that's just one example. It's just ridiculous that here I am, a veteran, and I have to go and buy drugs from drug dealers. And I'm tired of all this focus on what teenagers will do. There probably isn't a teenager in Vermont that can't go to their local high school and buy marijuana whenever they want. And that's my comment, and I appreciate your response. Thank you.
Paul, thanks very much for weighing in here. Let's go to Eric in Hartford. Hi, Eric. You go ahead.
Yeah, I totally agree with the previous caller, and I favor legalization. But in the opening soundbite, the governor mentioned a very strong line against edibles. And given, you know, if we're interested in public health, given that we know that smoke of any kind is unhealthy, why legalize the less healthy option? I mean, just because that's been how it's traditionally used recreationally, it seems to me that edibles should be legalized before smokables.
Eric, let me ask you this. If something like oil was legal so that you could buy that, or one could, I'm sorry not to put the pressure on you here, but if one could buy, say, oil and then make your own edibles, would that be an alternative that would be workable for you?
I think that makes more sense from a public health standpoint, that if we're going to legalize this, whether it be recreationally or medically, doesn't it make more sense to legalize the more healthy options? Because we know that smoke is ingesting smoke into your lungs, no matter what that smoke is of, no matter what you burn, ingesting smoke into your lungs is not a good idea, and in a medical setting especially.
Yeah, Eric, I take your point, and thank you. And I will put that here to Bill Lofi. I just want to add in a note that we got from S, who says, of course edibles should be legal. As you said, Eric, S says, smoking anything only compounds health issues. It's far healthier to ingest cannabis or anything else through the digestive tract than through the respiratory system. To the body, it's just another food substance which the digestive system is naturally equipped to handle, whereas the lungs aren't equipped to handle any kind of smoke inhalation. It's ludicrous to say that cannabis can be legal and then turn around and say, but it can only be delivered through smoking. What about as a tea? So, Bill Lofi, what do you think? I mean, nobody's saying that somebody can't go make edibles, but there is a question, and the governor has come out saying he doesn't want edibles to be on the table as something that is for sale for customers. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I look at it a little bit differently. I look at it from the perspective of what do we know about the products that we're consuming. One of the challenges that Colorado had, and I think there was a lot of publicity around Colorado, around the edibles, is that there was no, and there still is, no uniform standard by which Colorado, or Washington for that matter, or any other legalized state, tests cannabis. So it's actually hard to know exactly what is in the edibles that are being consumed. And I think that's a really important piece that Vermont can get right. And we can do so by establishing standardized, uniform standards for testing that will give us the ability to have a much, much better sense of what's in the product. Now, getting back to Eric's point, I think that he makes a really good one, which is if we're really talking about public safety and we're talking about driving the underground market out of business, it doesn't really make much sense to take out what is now a significant portion of Colorado and Washington's economy that would be similar in Vermont and keep that in the underground market. You know, maybe there is a compromise in which people can buy oil that they know what's measured, they know what's in it, and they can make it at home. I do worry about the notion that, well, just give people flour. They can go and take it at home and extract it, and they still aren't going to know exactly what is in their product. So I think that there could be some compromise there, but I do think that edibles are an important part of this economy, and for a lot of people, it's actually a much safer way to consume cannabis.
We're talking about what legal marijuana might actually look like in Vermont with Bill Lofi from the Vermont Cannabis Collaborative. Bill was just talking about what's happened in Colorado and some of the examples that we've seen about things like edibles and how that worked and didn't work in states like that. Well, coming up, we're going to go to Colorado. We're going to get some of those lessons learned. And we'll take more of your thoughts on what a framework for legalization might look like. You can call 1-800-639-2211 with your questions, your thoughts, your comments on this. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're spending some time looking at all the details that would need to be sorted out before Vermont could legalize the sale and consumption of recreational marijuana. It's something many lawmakers are in favor of. The governor called for it in last week's State of the State address. And the results of a February 2015 poll from the Castleton Polling Institute said that 54% of Vermonters support legalizing marijuana, 40% oppose legalization in the state, and 6% don't have an opinion on the issue. If you'd like to share your opinion, should you have one, on taxation, regulation, edibles, impaired driving tests, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Christy says it should be treated exactly the same way as alcohol, cigarettes, and the lotto. Taxed, and revenue should go towards needed state improvements like education, bridge, and road construction. We should be able to buy it in stores and have cannabis bars. Edibles in Vermont would be an amazing business opportunity considering our Vermont First campaign, and we should also incentivize farmers to grow it here instead of importing. But on that note, Robin in Brattleboro says, I keep hearing that we'll legalize marijuana the quote-unquote Vermont way. Ben & Jerry's started as a cottage industry, and it's now owned by an international corporation. How are we going to regulate an industry that really does not care about the health and well-being of our youth? Also, we can hear all we want about how tax dollars will support prevention, but look at what happened to the tobacco industry settlement dollars. They pave our highways now. We've been talking with Bill Lofi from the Vermont Cannabis Collective, and we're joined now by Luke Runyon, reporter for Harvest Public Media and KUNC, based at the University of Northern Colorado. And he joins us from Greeley, Colorado. Luke, nice to talk with you today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So my understanding of the way it worked in Colorado is that Colorado pretty much went all in. This was not really a phased-in approach for your state, minus the fact that there have been no cafes, no legal sort of public spaces where people can smoke or imbibe. Is that the case?
Yeah, so voters first legalized recreational and retail marijuana in 2012 here in Colorado and rolled out retail stores in 2014. So we're in the third year now of legalized marijuana out here in Colorado.
But no places where, like in Amsterdam, you can go to a cafe and sit and have a joint and a cup of coffee.
Nope, nothing like that yet. But we have had a proliferation of retail stores and medical marijuana dispensaries. So it's not uncommon to drive down any street in Denver or Fort Collins or Boulder and see pot shops on, you know, street corners. They have popped up just like coffee shops, but no smoking or partaking in the actual stores themselves. All of that has to be done in a private home.
Let's take a call here from Bob in Vergennes while we're talking about this. Hi, Bob. Go right ahead.
Hi, thanks. I do believe in the phased-in approach here in Vermont. I think it would be good to do the smokables for, you know, maybe a couple of years until maybe there's some better ways to regulate the edibles. I'd like to see, you know, Vermont is often at the forefront of different progressive issues, regardless of what it is. And it'd be great if maybe, you know, Vermont said, okay, edibles can only be this X amount of dosage for, you know, per serving, and it needs to be regulated by a lab or something like that. And then only those items that are certified could be allowed in the state. And maybe we would set the tone for others to follow suit and, you know, making it safer for everybody. But I think the phase-in approach would allow people to, you know, better understand the effects that if maybe they're new to it and decide to try it because it's legal before getting into the edibles that do have the propensity of causing the problems.
Bob, thanks for your comments. Appreciate that. Bill Lofi with the Vermont Cannabis Collaborative. What do you think about a phased-in approach or more of a sort of all-in idea?
I think a phased-in approach makes sense for Vermont. You know, I think that there's an argument to be made that, for example, on lounges, that may actually be a good idea. I think right now, I don't think that Vermont's ready for that. So certainly taking this one step at a time makes a lot of sense.
So something like the way Oregon did it, for example, where certain products couldn't be sold in for basically the first year, but then are expected to be phased in the fall of 2016, things like edibles.
Sure. And there's also just a practical component here, which is getting grow and cultivation operations up online. That takes some time and it takes some logistics. You don't want to open up this market and not have sufficient supply to meet demand. And so there's sort of a supply and demand component to this, which also argues for taking a slow and thoughtful approach.
Luke Runyon, do you think in what you've reported on for Colorado that Colorado leaders would advise states like Vermont to take it slow on edibles? We've now heard about edibles from a multitude of perspectives, and that certainly has caused some problems for consumers and for officials in Colorado.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier Colorado going in kind of all in, all at once, and I think that that's what happened here. You know, you talk to Colorado's Governor John Hickenlooper, and he says Colorado was engaging in this large experiment. A lot of rules and regulations were playing catch-up. You know, we weren't necessarily out in front of edibles. We weren't saying, you know, here's a standard serving size. Here's how much THC should be allowed in a single serving of an edible product. You know, here's how we should be designing edible products so that they don't appeal to children. All of that was happening while products were already on the market. So you were seeing recalls. You were seeing products that had to be pulled off shelves after rules came out. So it got a little messy, and it did feel a little bit like an experiment was going on.
We got a note from Eric in North Springfield who says, one thing that legalization in Colorado has shown is that when cars with Colorado plates drive into surrounding states, they're frequently stopped by police and searched for contraband. Surely this situation would be duplicated in our neighboring states if Vermont legalized marijuana. And let's just remember, Vermont would be the first state, I believe, in the Northeast to be legalizing marijuana. Luke Runyon, is that true? Have you heard that cops in neighboring states target Colorado drivers?
I feel like you definitely hear that, but I don't know if there's enough evidence to actually say that that's true. Just recently, there was a lawsuit that was filed on behalf of the states of Oklahoma and Nebraska against Colorado that was at the very core of their argument, saying that marijuana bleeding over the state's boundaries was causing problems for law enforcement in border counties in Nebraska and Oklahoma. But they weren't necessarily able to produce any evidence that showed that. I think it might be one of those myths, maybe. A lot of law enforcement like to say that that's the case, but they don't have the data to back that up.
Hmm.
I know I haven't been pulled over driving with my Colorado plates into Wyoming or Nebraska.
Yet. Bill Lofi, what do you say to officials in neighboring states who might be concerned, I mean, maybe about a multitude of things, if Vermont should be the state that legalizes marijuana first in our region?
Well, I guess I would say that there are actually a lot of benefits that we can establish here in Vermont and grow in Vermont, and that we could actually set new benchmarks for the rest of the country. Let me give you an example on this issue of impaired driving, which is a real one, and it's one that exists now. there is no effective roadside test. As you pointed out, Jane, in the intro, you need to send these samples to a lab. Well, there is actually a lot of progress being made. And just last month on VPR, I heard a story about the development of a roadside test that seems to hold a lot of promise for law enforcement. Where is that being developed? It's being developed at Washington State University. And the reason it's being developed there is because it is legal for them to do this study with participants because it's legal to consume cannabis. The point being is that we're seeing innovation in those very places where marijuana is legalized and regulated. And by the way, and one of the things that I think is really important to talk about is that we're also seeing economic growth and economic activity. And this is a good thing for the economy. When Washington State develops a roadside breathalyzer, that creates jobs. That brings income for their higher institution, higher institutions of learning. And, you know, that's a good thing. So there are ancillary benefits, I think, for other states. So while there may be some issues with Vermonters going into other states, my sense is that by the end of next year, we're going to see Massachusetts online. We could see Maine, and we could see Rhode Island. So I think as that happens and the region moves into full legalization, that will become less of an issue.
I want to ask about that or pose another thought here about that driving while impaired. We got a note from somebody who wants to go by the name Anonymous Driving Pot Smoker, who says, ever since I was 18, I've been a lifelong pot smoker. I've driven cars, buses, trucks, motorcycles, and bicycles in heavy traffic, most of the time having smoked pot before or while driving. Distracted driving notwithstanding, I have never had an accident, and I'm one of the safest, most careful drivers you'd ever hope to meet. I average about 25,000 miles of driving a year, including daily commuting, driving in big city traffic, and multi-hour road trips to far-flung destinations. Almost every one of those miles, I have had THC coursing through my veins, partly because pot acts like a stimulant for me and heightens my senses, as though I had drunk one or two strong cups of coffee. And this emailer is worried that new tests will come online that will prevent him or her from being able to smoke as perhaps legally he or she can and also drive on the roads. And, you know, it may be alarming to hear that this is somebody who drives 25,000 miles a year while smoking. But, you know, there are also questions, as we heard earlier, about what the appropriate level of THC in the bloodstream would be to call somebody impaired versus just seeing an impairment. So, Bill Lofi, I mean, even if we do have a test, how do we deal with that in Vermont?
Well, a couple of things. One is I don't want to be on the road with that person, and I think the idea that it sort of has no effect or that it helps driving is ludicrous. But this is a problem that exists now. It's happening right now. And so the question is, what are we going to do about it? I don't see a lot of activity here in Vermont currently that's getting at this issue of an effective roadside test. So what I think a more reasonable and a saner approach is to take some of the revenue that we are going to get. And yes, I know that legislators may not want to focus entirely on revenue, but we are going to be able to draw some revenue out of this. Put it into research and development. Let's utilize the regulation of cannabis as a way to make it safer and to make our roads safer. We can do those things at the same time, and Washington State is already showing it.
We got a note from Mark, who is a little bit skeptical of that idea that revenue is going to make much of a difference in his life anyway. He says, I'm all for legalization and taxation. I also, however, have no faith that any revenue the state captures from legal weed will do anything to lower my property taxes or the cost of living here for anyone. Luke Runyon, what about in Colorado? Has that revenue been something that people generally feel pretty favorable about?
I think so. So the amendment that first legalized marijuana for recreational use in Colorado, the money that was raised for that goes into a fund that pays for school maintenance and construction. So it's a very specific spending plan. You know, all of that, those, you know, tens of millions of dollars are going into that particular fund. Some licenses and fees on marijuana stores are going to research. So you're seeing grants going out from state agencies to universities to study the efficacy of medical marijuana, how it works, what conditions it might treat. So it's very specific spending. It's probably not going to affect somebody's property taxes or you know, the kinds of taxes that people pay on a regular basis.
Let's go to Joe calling in from Morrisville. Hi, Joe. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to talk. I just got back from the Judiciary Committee hearings where the Sheriff's Association and the State Police Association were talking. And they just went out and visited Colorado last year. and they seem to be under the impression that 40% of Colorado's market or Colorado's cannabis still goes to the illicit market. And I work in the industry out in Oregon, and I've never heard that stat before. I think that we're in a wonderful position where we have a small population, but a large population of cannabis growers here in the state. And I think that if Vermont legalizes and we are inclusive to our world-renowned cannabis growers here in the state, and we allow the growers to sell their wares to the state, that will take the cannabis off of the illicit market and put it on the legal market, which would drive up prices on the illicit market.
Joe, thanks for that. I got your point, and we're short on time here. So, Bill Lofi, I just want to ask you a very quick question, which is, do you have a sense of what the right level to tax that is so that you are destroying the illegal market but not, you know, overpricing legal cannabis?
I'm not sure what the exact amount is, Jane. I think that we've learned from Washington State not to overtax it. They taxed it many, many times over in the value chain, and it didn't actually drive down the underground market. I think the governor has this right. I think you do want to keep taxes low enough that you're going to drive the underground market out of business.
That's Bill Lofi. He's on the steering committee of the Vermont Cannabis Collaborative. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
We've also been talking with Luke Runyon. He's a reporter for Harvest Public Media and KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. Luke, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks, Jane.
More to come on marijuana legalization as the legislative session continues, so stay with VPR.net for all of your news on that. Coming up on this program, North America's first anti-radicalization center opened its doors in November in Montreal. We'll talk with the outreach coordinator about how the center operates. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The rise of Islamic State and other terrorist organizations have raised concerns about young people in Europe and the United States who get recruited to join and fight for these groups. An organization in Montreal was so alarmed by this prospect that it created a program dedicated to anti-radicalization. Joining us now from the Center for Prevention of Radicalization Leading to Violence is the center's outreach worker, Miriam Rabbani-Goslin. Miriam, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I understand that this organization, this program, started as a hotline almost a year ago, and the physical center opened to some fanfare in November in Montreal. What led you and others to create an organization dedicated to anti-radicalization?
So the organization, initially, it was a municipal effort. So it really came from the mayor and the chief of police, who really saw prevention as the main tool to counter radicalization, to counter violent radicalization. Obviously, there's a lot of measures that have been taken over the years to counter radicalization, but these measures were widely taken by the police departments, the security services, etc. They saw that, you know, the best way to counter this phenomenon is to really go towards prevention, and they decided to create the center. Now, quickly after the decision of creating the center, what happened is the provincial government actually jumped on board, and we became an NGO. So we're a non-governmental organization. We're a non-for-profit organization. We're not a municipal organization. We're really separated, completely separated from the government, from the police, from security services. We really stand alone, and this structure, the way we operate, really makes it work because people are not afraid to call us. Parents are not afraid to call us and report, for example, behaviors that they've observed with their children. Teachers are not, you know, afraid of calling us, talking about their students because they don't feel like they're calling the police. They really feel like they're calling an independent organization.
So is that how the process starts, is somebody calls in to say, I'm worried about this young person in my circle, whether it's a student of mine or a child of mine or, you know, a friend, somebody will call you and say, I'm concerned about some behavior.
right, usually this is how it works. People who call us, like I said, could be parents, but it could also be teachers, social workers. We also get calls from police officers and from just concerned citizens, neighbors, etc. So we get, and all of our calls obviously are confidential. Our line is confidential. It's a 24-hour hotline. And then here at the center, we have a team of social workers, psychotherapists, etc., who go out on the field to meet with people who call us when we feel like there's a situation that we need to go further. We need to offer some kind of help. Then we go on the field and we meet with people. The hotline has been launched in March of last year. So far, we've received about 500, and we're nearing 570 calls.
And how many of those are calls that you've then followed up on and talked to people?
About 115 is calls that we followed up. We followed up the call by direct intervention when we actually went out and met the family or met the teacher, or et cetera.
And how often do you then meet with the person in question, the young person?
Well, obviously, when we get a call about a specific individual, if through our evaluation we really believe that there is indeed a risk, then we automatically meet with the individual. But the way we do it is, obviously, we don't contact the individual directly in most of the cases, because we don't want to, you know, and when you talk about radicalization, you really have to stay away from confrontation, because confrontation does not work. You really have to take different means to reach out to that individual to make sure that she's in a position, she or he is in position to listen to what you have to say. So what we do is, sometimes if the parent thinks that we can go through the parents, like meet them with the parent at their house, then we do that. But also we can go through the schools. We can go through a friend. If the individual is involved in sports, then we can go through the coach. So we kind of find out, you know, who the most significant person is in that person's life, and we try to reach out to that person through that individual.
And then what do you actually do? What are you trying to say to somebody to turn them away from what you see as a very dark side?
Well, what's important is, here at the center, we don't use the word de-radicalization, because that's not what we feel that we do. Individuals are entitled to their ideas, obviously, and being radical is a positive thing, because throughout history we had radical thinkers, the feminist movement, Martin Luther King or Gandhi, and these are important. You know, it's important in democratic society that people are entitled to their ideas. So we don't do de-radicalization. What we do is disengagement from violence. So we only intervene when the person is engaged in a radical thinking process and they see violence as a way to reach their means. And what we do is to try to disengage the person from violence. So there's different, sometimes it's a follow-up with our psychotherapist that happens. Sometimes it's to give that young person different opportunities, connect them with different programs. It's not all the programs are done by ourselves. If there is a program in the community that is very successful with other types of violent behavior, then perhaps that person can go into that program. And we do follow up. We don't have a limit of sessions that person can get with our psychotherapist, for example, or with a psychiatrist if we need it, or with a social worker. All of services are completely free, and they go up until the person feels like they don't need the services anymore.
Miriam Rabbani-Goslin, you mentioned that it was very important for the center to be separate from the government, separate from the police, so that people don't feel like they're reporting a family member or a friend to mm-hmm. the authorities. But what happens if you get to the point where you think this person is actually a danger mm-hmm. and is leading towards violence and we're not having any success?
Right, and this is a very interesting question, because obviously when we talk about violent radicalization, we do get calls sometimes where we are very concerned about the security of the individual or the security of the family or the community. When that happens, then we do transfer to the police or to the security agencies. But out of all those 570 calls that we've got so far, only 8 cases were referred because we felt like there was an imminent danger. So we operate like a suicide hotline. When you call a suicide hotline, if the person on the other end feels like you are going to commit suicide in a very imminent, in a very short period of time, then they will call 911. And in that sense, we operate the same way. If we feel like there's an imminent threat, that definitely will transfer, but that's less than 1% of the time. Most of the time, a prevention, we can still do prevention, and the situation has not escalated enough that we feel like we have to transfer. At the same time, we do have protocols with the police and with security agencies that allow us to get information from them. But at the same time, what is great with our protocol is that we can get information from them, but they cannot get information from us unless there is an imminent threat to the person or to the population. And this is why we are trusted in the community, and people are, you know, and this is why we get that amount of calls, because the community really trusts when they call us.
Miriam Rabbani-Goslin is the outreach worker at the Center for Prevention of Radicalization Leading to Violence in Montreal. I understand it's the first anti-radicalization center in North America. Miriam, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about what you do.
Thanks for having me.
And that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, we have a jammed program for you, starting with a look at Governor Peter Shumlin's proposal to divest state money from coal companies. We'll do a reality check on that idea with State Treasurer Beth Pierce. Also, a visit to the Montshire Museum and lots of music in the show tomorrow. Join us for that at noon and at 7. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the show, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. If you ever miss any of Vermont Edition and want to hear it again, you can always find our segments online at vpr.net. And we encourage you to podcast the program. Wherever you find your podcasts, you will find Vermont Edition. Share it with your friends. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.